Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome special guests with us today. We have a student from Waupun High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. This is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from across the state to come and hear an oral argument with us. If they accept the invitation, they are given materials about the case. They may engage in activities relating to this case, come to the Supreme Court, sit and listen to the oral argument, and after the oral argument, a justice who has been assigned for the day to meet with the students meets with them after the second oral argument, and we're about to hear this second oral argument. The discussion of the students will be on the procedures of taking and hearing cases, not on the substantive issues involved in the case. And even if you're not a student, you're invited to attend the session. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, the marshal will give you a summary if you raise your hand. Does anyone want a summary of the case? All right. Let me then introduce the court to you all. Starting on my left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rogensack. Justice Rogensack will meet with the students after this oral argument. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right are two empty chairs. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will not participate in this oral argument. Seated next to the first empty chair is a second empty chair. Justice David Prosser will not participate in any December oral arguments. And on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for today, 10 AP 1551 CR. State versus Douglas M. Williams. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Williams is Stephen P. Hurley. We will then hear from Sally L. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. She will have 20 minutes and has ceded 10 minutes to Amicus, that is the Wisconsin Association of Judicial Court Commissioners and Wisconsin Family Court Commissioners, and Attorney John P. Axelrod will argue for them. And then, Mr. Hurley, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Hurley.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I should address at the outset what the standard of review is. This is an appeal from a decision of a circuit court judge denying a motion to suppress evidence, that evidence having been seized pursuant to a search warrant. With respect to facts in the case, the standard of review is whether the court's assessment of the facts was clearly erroneous. Facts in this case are not in dispute. With respect to the application of the law, the court looks at the application of the law de novo. I think it is of some import that the court have a brief history of the evolution of Article 7, Section 23 of the Constitution, which dealt with court commissioners. It existed in a form prior to 1977. In 1976, this court decided a case called State X. Rel. Perry versus Wolke. And in that case, this court was asked to determine whether a court commissioner could hear a preliminary examination. Because at that time the statute enacted by the legislature did not permit court commissioners to hear preliminary examinations, the court found that they in fact could not. Subsequent to that decision and before the 1977 constitutional amendment, the legislature amended the statute dealing with court commissioners, and at that time amended it in a way to permit court commissioners to hear preliminary examinations as well as to deal with other matters that they had not been able to previously. It was thereafter that the Constitution was amended. And that amendment did many things. It created a unified court system. It did away with county courts. It created a court of appeals. But with respect to the issue raised today, it did two very important things. Not one, but two. First, it repealed Article 7, Section 23, the portion of the Constitution through which court commissioners derived their authority. And in doing so, repealed the section which permitted the legislature to invest court commissioners with judicial power. But the second thing which the amendment did was in changing Section 2 of Article 7. And there it fundamentally altered the way in which judicial power is vested. Because prior to that time, judicial power could be vested in individuals. But with the amendment of Article 7, Section 2, thereafter, judicial power can be vested only in a court. That is an institution, not an individual. Formerly, the Constitution permitted vesting judicial power in persons, and specifically persons who were designated by the legislature. But now the Constitution has changed, and that power can only be vested in a court, the institution. And the Constitution says that that institution is peopled by judges, elected judges. It is elected judges who are those that are constitutionally permitted to wield judicial power. It can no longer be assigned by the legislature.
Counsel?
Yes.
I don't want to interrupt you because what you're doing is really good and it's helpful. So, but if I could get you to help me a little bit in the course of what you're doing, I'd appreciate it. In the federal system, magistrates issue a lot of search warrants.
Yes.
How is the federal constitution and federal statutes, how are they different from our Wisconsin ones? Or are those just apples and oranges and we shouldn't even consider that as an analogous situation?
Well,
or are all magistrate search warrants invalid?
No, not at all. The difference is that the federal constitution recognizes a two-tier system for judges. That is, there are Article III judges with lifetime appointments, but there are also Article I judges. And those Article I judges may be created by legislation. And magistrates would fall within that category. We no longer have a comparable system. So to an extent, it is apples and oranges.
Okay.
The changes which were made with the 1977 amendment were structural changes.
Counselor, I want to go to something a little bit more basic than
Sure.
where you are. Define for me what you think is a judicial power under Article 7, Section 2, as it currently exists, and if you can contrast it with something that perhaps a court commissioner does that you wouldn't consider a judicial power under
Certainly.
The Constitution.
Judicial power is exercised any time orders are issued which alter relationships between people or which alter people's relationships with liberty or property. So, performing a marriage does none of those things. Conducting a settlement conference does none of those things. Conducting an initial appearance in misdemeanor cases does none of those things. Setting a bail does those things. Conducting a preliminary hearing does those things.
So you'd say they don't have the powers to, a commissioner does not have the power to set bail or do a preliminary?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What about in the family law area, their whole list of things they can do?
If it alters relationships between people or relationships between persons and their property or liberty, then they may not do so. That is the exercise of a judicial power.
So we don't need court commissioners anymore in the state?
Necessity is not the issue, Your Honor. I'd be the first to stand here and say that they do very good work and very important work.
Right.
That isn't
okay,
the question.
Okay, that's different. But so court commissioners, other than perhaps scheduling a matter or something like that, really can't sit over meaningful proceedings and cases?
What is meaningful is in the eye of the beholder, Your Honor. And I wouldn't...
Well, they can't do small claims trials. They can't do preliminary proceedings in family cases. They can't do prelims. They can't set bail. They can't... They could do a telephone scheduling conference, maybe, or they could do a scheduling order.
They could not issue a final order. Could they make a report and recommendation to a judge who would issue a final order? Yes.
Could they have the hearing?
Pardon me?
Could they have the hearing?
Certainly they could have the hearing and issue a report and recommendation. But to make the final order.
Okay. So the judge, court commissioners can do everything they currently do except the judge has to sign the document?
The judge has to make the decision, not sign the document. Make the decision.
So review the report.
Review the report.
And then make a decision on the basis of the report.
In many instances, that would work. And I want to answer your questions and I want to help. But I'm not here really to argue that there are other solutions to the problem. What I'm here to tell you is the people voted to have judges make those decisions, not unelected court commissioners. That's what the amendment to the Constitution did. And this court may not delegate, neither this court nor any court in the state may delegate judicial power to an unelected individual. There is no decision of this court or any other cited by the state in which the delegation of judicial power to some unelected individual has ever been recognized to be valid.
Does it matter that court commissioners' decisions are reviewed de novo by circuit court judges?
There is de novo and de novo. That is, in this case, we present the court with the question of a search warrant. De novo review of a search warrant is not permitted by this very court's prior decisions. Indeed, this court's prior decisions that say that deference must be given to the issuing magistrate or court commissioner.
So maybe what you're saying is those other kinds of hearings, I don't know. We don't have to decide those today because those are subject to de novo review. But what I'm here to talk to you today about, you say, is search warrants. And because those are not subject to de novo review, this is a clear area where commissioners cannot act.
Yes, that is, I mean, if I'm not here to tell you there aren't broader implications of the issue that we raise. Amici wouldn't have appeared in this case were there not broader implications. But I'm presenting a very narrow issue, which this court can broaden as it chooses to. In the case of a search warrant, the issuance of the search warrant is, in fact, a final order. The moment that the search warrant is executed, the police carry out a function which invades another person's liberty and their right to be secure in their homes in a way that can never be repaired by any review of any court at any time. That aspect of liberty is lost and lost forever.
What about
and that is why the issuance of a search warrant is a judicial function.
But then what about the fact that when a temporary order issues, let's say in a really important area like children, you know, visitation, custody, placement. Once that issues, they have to comply with that unless and until, you know, a month later or whenever they get another hearing and they get de novo review. But that's pretty immediate and significant and important as well.
It is, and it is a judicial function. And the people of this state voted to have judges perform that function. And so it is a question of giving effect to what the people of this state voted for when they directly amended the Constitution.
Now,
Mr. Hurley,
Justice Crooks,
if I might, you started out by giving us some history of the constitutional amendments of 1977. There's another history that at least I think bears on all of this. And so give me a minute to preface this question. When I first came on the court, which was 1996, the Chief Justice sitting to my right had just become the Chief Justice. And within a year or so, she asked Justice Bradley and myself to take on a project on behalf of the court. And that project related directly to, first of all, enacting Supreme Court rules, SCRs, that would directly involve court commissioners, what they could do, what they couldn't do, how it was to tie in with the chief judge of the district, how it was to be under the supervision, ultimately, of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Without getting into a lot of detail, we undertook that project. We had the assistance of a lot of other people, including the people on the what's referred to as the PPAC committee. And we enacted Supreme Court rules. We then worked with the legislature, with the especially the Judiciary Committee of the Senate and of the Assembly. And the legislature enacted statutes that were consistent with the Supreme Court rules and tracked the Supreme Court rules. Now, when I look at the issues that are presented here, I look at those issues as I understand them in terms of, is this okay, what we're asking in regard to court commissioners and search rules under Article 7, Section 2? We're also asked about the inherent power or authority of the courts. Now, it's talked in terms of circuit courts, but it also could be very much talked in terms of the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin. And then we're asked about the good faith exception, the Eason case, and how that would apply here. It strikes me that you can't ignore that second history, if you will, the history starting in about 1997 and culminating, I think, in about 2001, and how all of that relates to this situation. It seems to me, and I want to hear your response to this, it seems to me it strengthens the argument that indeed commissioners do have authority under the Wisconsin Constitution, and certainly with the inherent power of the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin, as well as inherent power in circuit judges, to be able to allow the court commissioners to issue search warrants. And I'm looking for what's your response to that.
I'll try to take it in order.
A long question. I
understand. Long question. Many issues. With respect to inherent power, this court has never held that the court, any court, the Supreme Court, the appellate court, a circuit court, has the inherent power to delegate judicial power to someone else, especially someone unelected. And indeed, it flies in the face of the Constitution itself, especially in light of the 77 Amendment, which finally and solely invested courts with judicial power, and at the same time eliminated the constitutional recognition of any position of court commissioner or lesser judge. Indeed, the whole point, one of the whole points of the 1977 amendments was to get away from multi-tiered judges at the county level. So I don't think that delegating judicial power has ever been fallen within the rubric of inherent powers of the court. Judicial power is vested in courts because the Constitution explicitly makes elected judges the vessels that wield that judicial power on behalf of the institution. And so it is not within the inherent power of a court to give its power to an unelected individual.
So reserve judges couldn't do this either, because they're no longer elected, they've retired.
It's an interesting question to which I'd not given thought.
Sorry.
It may be. I can't say definitively. I hadn't thought about it, but it may be. You know, that it is, I understand that there is much talk about election versus appointment of judges, what is a better system, but the bottom line is the people of the state have spoken about what their system is. And it says elected judges wield judicial power, period. Not anyone else. That isn't the case in other states. It isn't the case necessarily under, it certainly isn't the case under the federal system. It isn't the case under many of the, in many of the states where the state relies on decisions of those states' courts. That is the case here. And we have to give effect to the scheme that was voted on directly by the people.
Well, one of the indicia of the scheme voted on by the people is what the legislature does close in time to the constitutional amendment.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead. Why?
Legislative intent is irrelevant. It is irrelevant to legislation that was voted on by the people. Because the legislative intent does not tell us what the electors thought at the time they voted on this. The legislature did not vote on passage of this amendment. The legislator voted on predicate legislation to put the issue before the people.
Right. And on what should be on the ballot? I mean, the whole amendment is preceded or is on the ballot by a question and various commentary. And if you look at the Legislative Council that preceded this constitutional amendment, their notes, if you look at the drafters' notes on the joint resolutions, they indicate that the court commissioners were going to still be available. That is, they'll be still important in the judicial system.
That was not on the ballot that the people voted on.
No, but that's part of the legislative history of the joint resolutions. It was part of the task force, the Blue Ribbon Committee that Governor Lucey appointed.
And if one views all of that history in the light most favorable to the state, it is irrelevant. Because the amendment is the product of the people's vote and their intent, whatever it is, and I, for one, don't know how to measure the people's intent.
You can only do it by what was submitted to them. At least that's one way of doing it. Plus, we've done it with newspaper articles at the time.
But one looks at intent when the plain language is unclear. Here, the plain language is extraordinarily clear.
Well, what's not clear is just what the meaning of judicial power is.
I believe that judicial power is exercised when the court alters relationships between people or deprives people of liberty or property. And fundamentally,
whether or not it's final.
Pardon me?
Whether or not that decision is final.
This court has never said that what a final decision is. Final has many meanings depending on whether it's in the circuit court or a court of appeals or the Supreme Court.
And for what purpose, whether it's for appeal or
That's correct.
Something else.
These are unclear terms, as is the term de novo review. And so to depend on an unclear term to define it, I think is just going to tee up more problems in the future. Certainly, judicial power is exercised when persons are deprived of liberty or property. And I don't think that's a hard one, nor do I think it's a difficult one when judicial power is used to alter relationships between people, that is, to take a child away from the child's parents. Those, I think, are pretty fundamental core functions of the judiciary.
I think it's interesting that you find custody matters a judicial function, but not marriages, because I always kind of thought marriages altered relationships between people.
Yes, but voluntarily so.
Okay, so if the people... I gotcha. Okay, so that was another part of your criteria. I didn't get that from your first answer, but thank you.
Well, the point is you can waive and
can
get
waive
something.
Anything.
Well, in a marriage, you appear voluntarily, and oftentimes, usually, we hope it's voluntarily. Okay, thank you.
You know, counsel, you mentioned earlier, we all come to cases with different perspectives. Lawyers do, different judges do. I approach this one through the lens of inherent judicial authority, and you mentioned earlier that this court has never exercised its inherent authority to say that judicial powers can be vested in anyone but an elected judge. I think I've summed that up. The seven of us being collectively responsible for the administration of courts and judges, among others, in this state, what would prevent us from doing that? To say that, starting with In Re Janitor, where this court held that the presence of a custodian as necessary to the functioning of the court. That was the landmark case establishing inherent judicial authority. What would prevent us from collectively saying, in order to administer justice to the people of this state, we are going to grant limited authority to certain individuals who meet certain criteria under certain circumstances? Why couldn't we do that?
Well, the easy answer is you're the Supreme Court, and you can do whatever you want as long as the people don't storm the Bastille afterwards. But
let's hope we're setting the bar a little higher than that.
Right. And it's the Constitution, because when you do that, what you're saying is you don't have to be elected to wield judicial power. And that is a huge decision, because that is how we people our courts, is through elected judges. Now, the state, in this case, wants to draw a distinction between what it calls parajudicial or quasi-judicial functions, which is kind of like saying there's a penumbra of judicial functions. And it relies on out-of-state cases and other states' constitutions to come to this conclusion. There are functions which are judicial. There are those which are not. I have offered a line to draw in order to make that distinction. And I suppose the court, if it wished to, could draw the line in a different place. But there is a line somewhere. And whatever is judicial is required by our constitutional scheme to be performed by an elected judge, not someone who is appointed. This issue came to light in a case I had almost 2 years ago. Not in this case. This first came up in a case where I appeared in a different county in front of a court commissioner on an initial appearance in a case where an arrest warrant had been signed by a judge and bail had been set. And I went to that court, and I got there a half hour early, and I watched a court commissioner for a half hour be absolutely abusive to all the unrepresented people who appeared in front of him. And I was alarmed, because for most people, this is the first and perhaps only contact they have with a court system. And when my case was called, the court commissioner took up the question of bail. And I said, Your Honor, A judge has already said it. And he said, well, I can set bail. So I drove back to Madison afterwards thinking to myself, how does a court commissioner overrule a judge? How do you get rid of someone if they're being abusive to people? And that's when I went back to the books and discovered that they can only be removed by the chief judge, the person who appointed them, that they don't have to live in the county that they serve, that their qualifications are less than that of a judge, though they are performing functions which are judicial in nature because a judge performs them as well. And that's what got me looking at the Constitution, and when I saw that Article 7, Section 23 was repealed, and saw at the same time that Article 7, Section 2 had removed from the legislature the power to give judicial authority or judicial power to an individual, that we decided it was solely vested in courts.
Thank you.
No, I don't want to
Justice Rogenstein.
I have one more question. I'm still mulling over your voluntary distinction that you made in marriages and custody. Would you say then that a custody order that was signed by a court commissioner based on the agreement of the parties was not an exercise of judicial power because it was the parties consented to the order? Certainly alters their relationship.
No. And
the voluntariness then isn't such a
voluntariness is a part of it, but performing a marriage has never been recognized to be a judicial function. That is why a religious official may perform a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It is not historically or inherently judicial. It is something that is tacked on to a judge's duties. But it is not a judicial function.
Okay, so the voluntariness was really not a necessary part of that.
No, it is a part.
The custody order you're saying that's consented to, that's signed by a court commissioner, you would still consider that to be a judicial function, the signing of that order?
Yes, but one can expressly waive.
Right. But I'm just looking at, I'm trying to determine the
yes.
definition of what I think is
yes.
under the Constitution.
I think a custody
function.
Order fundamentally alters relationships between people.
Okay.
And it is an alteration that cannot occur absent a court's interjection into the matter.
Okay. All right. I understand better now your position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman.
Sorry, I was trying to lower the podium and it didn't lower any further. I'm sorry. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the state of Wisconsin, which is the plaintiff respondent in this case. Let me first discuss the issue of what is judicial power. And obviously the term itself, as with so many terms in the law, means different things depending on the context and how it's being used. This court, however, has already told us a great deal, and a great deal that is, in fact, dispositive in this case, I believe, about what judicial power, the exclusive judicial power that can only be exercised by a court, a constitutional Article 7, Section 2 court, and that it did in Van Brocklin, in which it said that the authority to issue a search warrant could be delegated to a clerk, to a non-elected court, because it didn't vest the judicial power that's exclusively reserved for a court. Because that judicial power that's exclusively reserved for a court is the ultimate adjudicative power to decide and pronounce a judgment and carry it into effect, to adjudicate ultimate claims, pronounce final orders and judgments that binds the parties. Lesser determinations, preliminary determinations, ex parte determinations, like search warrants, like preliminary custody orders, restraining orders, those are not adjudicative of the merits. They're not final in the sense used. They don't dispose of the ultimate merits of the case binding on the parties.
Also, there's another difference between you and Mr. Hurley's definition. His seems to be operating on a different temporal scheme than yours is. He says when you issue a search warrant and someone comes into your house against your will based on that warrant, at that moment in time, you've come upon their constitutionally protected rights in a way you could not without the warrant. And you seem to argue, as you begin and also in the material submitted to us, that that warrant is subject to review, and so because you can review it later, we don't worry about what happened earlier. So could you address the temporal differences between your positions for me?
Well, there certainly is a temporal difference, and we do believe that one of the reasons that it is not, that issuing a search warrant is not the ultimate adjudicative power that's reserved exclusively for courts constitutionally, is because it is reviewable then by a court, by the circuit court.
Right.
Mr. Hurley's definition, while it's uniquely suited to his issue, which is the search warrant, because it does immediately, there's no question that when a search warrant is executed, that person, whether it turns out ultimately to be right or wrong, their liberty interest and possibly their property interest, their privacy interest is immediately invaded. And if that turns out to be wrong, they can never get that back. I understand that. But that's not the test. That language that he uses in his brief and in his argument, he cites to no court authority whatsoever that has ever defined judicial power in that way. And it's so broad that it actually, in his brief, and in his argument, it's so broad, any act that alters the liberty or property interest of an individual such that it can never be fully restored later, that would go to a police. If you take that the way, as broadly as he pronounces it, a police officer could not make an arrest on the street because that immediately alters the liberty interest of that person. And in fact, it isn't the issuance of the search warrant, really, that impairs any kind of interest, because if the search warrant is never executed, no liberty or property or privacy interest is invaded. It may be that, and it happens rarely, but it does happen, a search warrant is issued, and then the police discover things that make them think, oh, wait, we want to find out more. We don't want to tip our hand too soon. We're not going to execute now. It's never executed. The person who lived in the home that it was going to be searched never even knew it existed. So it's the execution of the warrant that is altering immediately that liberty interest and that property and privacy interest, which would suggest that only a court can execute a search warrant.
Well, but it's recognized that the executive branch has powers, right?
Right.
And one of the powers is arrest, which has been recognized pre-Constitution, right?
Right.
So the fact that the executive has powers for arrest doesn't mean that if there's a search warrant, that the search warrant is not an exercise of judicial powers. Because if the officer makes an arrest that is illegal without a search warrant, right? The execution of the warrant is a judicial function, a recognition of what is or is not available and legal and constitutional.
I'm not sure.
The executive branch and the judicial branch may have powers on arrest, right?
Yes, that's true.
That's right. So the fact that the executive branch has a power to arrest without a warrant, that doesn't mean that arrest is an executive branch issue.
Exclusively,
that's right.
Right.
It is a judicial branch issue. Two, is it exclusive to the judicial branch? Issuing a warrant may or may not be, and that's the issue here.
Right.
But the fact that the executive branch implements what the judicial branch does, that's true of every order. well, can be true, that the sheriff has to implement it. That's executive branch. So the fact that the executive branch has powers doesn't mean and doesn't define what the judicial branch can do.
Correct.
That's why
I don't find
your discussion of the arrest powers significant.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. And my point was simply that his definition is so broad.
That's right.
And it has no foundation in any legal authority that he has cited or that I'm aware of.
But well, I know, but there always has to be a first case.
That's
right.
True.
But counsel, there may be some play in the fact that the Constitution vests people with certain security in searches and seizures. And police and judges and whomever can't just barge into someone's home or go arrest them for no reason whatsoever. There has to be probable cause. And that seems to be the thing that is a joint possible determination. The executive branch on their own, law enforcement on their own, can say, I have probable cause to arrest that person. They don't need a judge to say you get to go arrest the person. They go arrest the person based upon their own determination of probable cause. That can be reviewed later, but that is their determination. When they decide to go to a judge and say, I'd like a search warrant to search the home, the judge has to make a determination of probable cause. Otherwise, the warrant doesn't issue. But the judge doesn't go arrest the person. Law enforcement has to arrest the person. So the right vested in people is the right to have probable cause, a probable cause determination before search or seizure. And that is a possible joint determination, if you will. But the right to arrest, judges don't go arrest people.
Right.
We don't go search people's homes.
Correct, and I understand your point.
Well, that was your point,
right.
I think, which does
that
have
his
some merit.
I'm sorry, my point was only to say that his definition is so broad it would encompass these other things.
If the complaint, then, is that there wasn't probable cause, that's typically what we review. Boy, was this invalid because there wasn't probable cause in the search warrant. This person's rights were violated. But Mr. Hurley, I think, creatively and maybe appropriately says, look, you have to be an elected judge in order to make that determination of probable cause and issue the search warrant. But
and that certainly leads us into whether the repeal of Section 23 does remove the authority of the legislature to create the Office of Court Commissioner and give the duties to court commissioners and expand the duties as it has done. And we absolutely disagree with Mr. Hurley's position that legislative intent is irrelevant. It is true. The people, of course, have to ratify a constitutional amendment. But what they ratified is what was offered to them, what was put before them by the legislature to successive legislatures, as set forth in the referendum questions. So it isn't just the people out of whole cloth coming up with this. And in Dairyland, Greyhound Park versus Doyle, and more recent cases as well, this court has said, yes, we look at what was happening contemporaneously. We look at the ratification process, what was out there to the people, what was going on contemporaneously, and we look at what did the legislature do immediately after the enactment of the amendment or the amendment of the Constitution, because that tells us what they believe the intent was.
Ms. Wellman, when we look at that contemporaneous information, is there any place that you've come across where there's an indication that the effect of the constitutional amendment would eliminate court commissioners?
No. Everything I found and everything that anyone else has cited in the amici, which was very helpful, with the legislative history, has been that all it did was say, we did leave this to the legislature and the court. It's a shared power. And as you aptly noticed in your earlier question, obviously the creation of Supreme Court Rule Chapter 75, which speaks to court commissioners and instituted new things that had not previously been in existence for court commissioners, including them being subject to judicial commission review, certain qualifications, all of those things, which...
Then educational requirements.
Yes, continuing legal education equivalents. All of that, it's a shared power that this court and the legislature can both exercise. And the legislature, let's remember, and this goes back a little bit to a question way early on, not to get too deeply into it, but there is a fundamental difference between the federal constitution and the state constitution. Under the state constitution, the legislature has plenary power to enact anything in the public good unless it's expressly prohibited by the state constitution. And Mr. Hurley is equating the repeal of Section 23, even though all of the contemporaneous and immediately following history shows it was repealed only because it was viewed as unnecessary. It was a matter of court and inherent court power, the Supreme Court's superintending power and legislative power, and more efficiently and effectively dealt with there. So it was left there. There is no, he's reading the repeal alone as a prohibition on the legislature that henceforth you cannot regulate in this area. You cannot create such an office. You cannot delegate parajudicial, quasi-judicial, limited, subordinate judicial powers to a non-elected judge. And the repeal alone does not say that. And given our constitutional structure, in order to do that, we believe that the Constitution would have to both expressly repeal and prohibit, that the repeal alone does not do that.
Well, the repeal is a good first step.
It's the first step, and that's all it is.
And the first question that was submitted to the voters says, shall Sections 5, 11, and 16 to 23 of Article 7 be repealed, right? So they had to, if they voted for that, check me out.
Yes.
Okay. Then it says, gives you several amendments, including Section 2 to 4. And then it says, and shall Section 4, 3 of Article 7 and 16, blah, blah, of Article 14 be created so as to provide for a unified court system under the administrative authority of the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice, consisting of, and then it lists courts, says nothing about commissioners. The second question dealt with the Court of Appeals, which I don't think is applicable here. The third question deals with the court system disciplinary proceedings, which sets forth discipline of judges, which is not applicable here. The fourth deals with mandatory retirement age, which lifts it, except that the legislature can set it again, mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
So that which went to the to the people just has a repeal. And I agree that what I recited to counsel for Mr. Williams is the typical way of our interpreting the Constitution, which is to look at legislative enactments. But legislative enactments can, even if they think it's constitutional, we might not on further reflection, right?
Right.
So, what is your definition of judicial power?
My definition is the definition that's set forth in Van Brocklin.
Well, Van Brocklin is a 1928 case, right?
Right.
At that time, you had a constitutional amendment that dealt with commissioners, but this was not a commissioner case. It happened to be a municipal court
right.
case, right?
Right.
And municipal courts are different, and they're set up by the legislature. Was that true pre-1978, too?
I'm not positive. I think so, but I'm not positive.
Okay. So you'd have to take some of the language out of Justice Owen's case, which is a very broad, but it says, while the reasoning upon which the warrant was upheld was based on a fiction, and as now appears unnecessary. Nevertheless, the expediency of the practice was recognized and the power sustained, referring to a whole series of things. But it doesn't say anything about commissioners. There's a strong dissent in the case saying a search warrant is different from an arrest warrant, because the arrest warrant just, it does interfere with liberty, but it brings you right to a judge.
Right.
Whereas a search warrant is of immediate effect, and that it interferes with liberty and personal property, and says that can't do it without a judge. It's judicial power to have a search warrant that can be lawfully administered. You agree it's not a ministerial?
Correct.
So if what are there any powers given to the commissioners? There's a whole long list of powers. Any that in your view are dubious under the Constitution?
The only one that I think might fall within the closer to the adjudicative, ultimate adjudicative power is the accepting a guilty plea with the consent of both parties. But since it's only with the consent of both parties, it seems to me that obviously the parties could consent to that. So I don't think that any of the other powers certainly come anywhere close to being the core judicial function that only a court can exercise.
Nothing about custody or child support?
No, because in part because they're all reviewable, ultimately, by a circuit court. And again, in C.
What does de novo mean in that review? I mean, obviously, the legislature thought that was important because
right.
it put into Section 8
right.
de novo review. Court commissioners generally don't make a record, do they?
My understanding is that they, I guess I don't know. My understanding was that they did not previously, but they currently do. But I could be wrong on that. And I know they did.
If they do, it's not with ordinarily with a stenographic reporter. It's with tape. And I'm not sure that they all do that.
I can't. Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess
and
I should just leave it at that.
Do you view de novo as taking additional evidence? Or
well,
just reviewing the record in subsection 8?
If a de novo review is requested, that there is that case, and I think it's, can't remember if it's cited in the briefs or not, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, it's a divorce case. It's like
and what do you
Stalkus
think
versus Stalkus, I think. Anyway, it said that in that situation, the person was entitled to an evidentiary hearing in front of the judge de novo. If he requested, because that was that's what de novo meant, and he could present evidence and do things that he had not done before. In the search warrant context, it gets a little, there's more gray area because the case law that Mr. Hurley relies on and that I'm familiar with all speaks to appellate review of a search warrant. And review is deferential because of the Fourth Amendment's great preference for warrants, which is almost a part of the policy or substantive aspect of the Fourth Amendment itself. So even in de novo review, that de novo review, whatever it is going to be bound by the underlying substantive law. But we don't have a case, actually, to my knowledge, that where a criminal defendant has challenged a search warrant issued by a court commissioner and asked for de novo review, and it has been held that he does not get de novo review, meaning at least non-deferential review. Now, if it's submitted in paper, I suppose reviewing the same paper is de novo in that sense. Whether the deference is absolutely required, I think that's just an open question. But given, so I don't think even, let me say two things. One, I don't think even if this court were to hold, and this would not be an appropriate case to hold it because Mr. Williams never asked for de novo review, of the search warrant. He's never challenged the probable cause or any aspect of the search warrant whatsoever, except this constitutional challenge. But if in a future case the question were to be presented whether in the limited place where a circuit court's reviewing a court commissioner's search warrant, the deferential standard gives way, I don't know what the answer to that would be. We don't think it's fatal, however, to our argument that it's not the exclusively judicial function that only a court can exercise because, again, it is preliminary, it is ultimately reviewed, it is not adjudicative on the merits of the case between the parties.
Well, suppose that, and I didn't look at this under court commissioners. Could court commissioners hold small claims cases?
They do act in small claims cases.
And final adjudications in small claims cases?
No, they're de novo.
I'm not sure about that. If I may, perhaps I could defer to amicus counsel, who is much more experienced, as I am not at all experienced in the civil area and small claims area.
Well,
I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
I'll look that up, and you can look it up, too, when you're seated, because then the question is, if they do that adjudication, whether or not you get a review de novo in circuit court. Now, you do, even when a judge sits in small claims court, you can get de novo review, is my understanding.
If that is correct, I don't know why it would be different, but
okay.
I know I see my red light is right on.
Thank you. Mr. Axelrod.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I think the Dairyland case, which was cited by Ms. Wellman, is very instructive. In the concurring opinion, which was not disputed by any of the other opinions, at paragraph 115, the opinion states, our methodology in interpreting a constitutional provision envisions more intense review of extrinsic sources than our methodology in statutory interpretation. And there's just absolutely no question that the Legislative Reference Bureau said that court commissioners are going to continue under statutory law. And there's really a number of constitutional provisions that support that. First of all,
do you think this court is bound by what the legislature interprets judicial power to be?
I think that that, as the Dairyland case says, it has to be intensely reviewed as part of this court's decision. But let's look at the 1970s.
So it's not binding, but it's one more indicia.
It is. Mm-hmm. But let's look at the provisions of the 1977 amendment itself. The council would have you believe that the legislature had no role whatsoever. And that's not correct, because the 1977 amendment gives the legislature the power to set up a whole series of trial courts that don't exist so long as their jurisdiction is statewide.
Do you think that a commissioner is a trial court?
Well, I certainly think, Your Honor, that that if the greater power is granted to the legislature to create a whole cadre of commissioner courts, that there's an implied lesser power to have commissioners function under the circuit court.
So, Mr. Axelrod, let me ask you, there were several things repealed through the 1977 change in this constitutional section. And, you know, style of writs and indictments, for example, publication of laws and decisions. It wasn't just dealing with court commissioners. And if this is an unfair question, I don't intend to ask you an unfair question, but has the legislature dealt anywhere legislatively with style of writs or indictments? Are there sections that deal with indictments? Is there anything that deals with publication of law and decisions? Have they addressed anything else legislatively that was repealed?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. But the second provision of the Constitution, which I think is extremely important, is this court's superintending authority. That's in the Constitution. And it was no doubt that the court exercised that superintending authority when it promulgated SCR 75.02 through SCR 75.09. So I think one could argue that even if the legislature didn't have power in this area, which I think it does, that this court certainly has superintending authority. Certainly, if counsel was correct that judicial power was limited to the circuit court, the Court of Appeals, the municipal court, and the Supreme Court, then that last clause in the 1977 amendments would not exist. But let's look at how this court has exercised its superintending authority. This court, to use the verbiage of 75.02 sub 1, recognizes that there is a court commissioner who, in the words of this court, performs limited judicial functions and quasi-judicial functions. And obviously, this court has spoken in 75.02, and Mr. Hurley, I think, would be asking this court to declare that this court promulgated an unconstitutional rule if you follow through with what he's arguing.
You know, that rule is sort of interesting. One, a court commissioner cannot exercise a power unless the chief judge specifically states it. So it may the court commissioner may have a whole laundry list of powers in the statute, but any particular commissioner cannot exercise a power unless the chief judge says it.
There's no challenge, Your Honor, that the chief. There's no challenge that the chief judge did not provide that power to the commissioner that issued that search warrant.
Talking about court powers and legislative powers. The other interesting thing about that SCR, it says that if the legislature changes powers, and I can look it up, but it's either adds or changes a commissioner's powers, then, according to our rule, we have 30 days to say aye or nay.
Subsection 2B, correct.
That's right, which is very unusual. And Justice Crooks gave you what I think is a very accurate statement of looking at the court commissioners in the 90s. We found, or I found, that court didn't even have a list of all the court commissioners in this state, had no idea how many of them were out there, had no idea how they were being appointed, how they were being released, or what their powers were in each of the counties. And a part of this SCR was to get a handle on what was happening since they were all under the administration, even though set up by the counties, all subject to the circuit courts and or us in dealing with important functions that affected the lives of people every day in our court system. And so the court obviously had great concern about what powers they were exercising because the judicial powers are vested in named courts, with us having superintending and administrative powers.
I think, Your Honor, that when the court used this used the term limited judicial and quasi-judicial functions, that this court was recognizing that in a complex technological society such as we live in, that courts could not, the judicial power could not exist unless there was some type of delegation. And
well, it has nothing to do with the, I don't think, it's a complex society. We've had court commissioners before society was so complex. Of course, at that time, they would have said society was complex anyway, right?
Well, certainly there their judicial power, I think there's a recognition in 75.02 sub 1 that judicial powers can be delegated to a limited extent. And I think that...
Let's talk about delegation, okay? There's another provision here that says if you're going to delegate, you're going to delegate for proper disposition of judicial business, right? Effective and fair administration. Well, Section 4, subsection 3, or paragraph 3 says, the Chief Justice may assign any judge of a court of record to aid in the proper disposition of judicial business in any court of record except the Supreme Court. Now, how do you read that? Does that mean that the counties or the chief judge of the district can assign a non-judge to aid in the proper disposition of judicial business?
Well,
does
certainly.
This mean that I, as Chief Justice, can't assign a judge of a court to sit here, but maybe I can assign a non-judge to sit here for the proper disposition of business?
Well, fortunately, we don't have that issue because under Chapter 75, court commissioners...
My colleagues don't like the idea that I would bring on two more people, non-judges, to sit on this case.
I think that's unanimous.
Counsel, I'd like to get you back a little bit to the search warrant that we're talking about here rather than looking at a broader picture. My main concern continues to be how you define judicial power as it's used in the Constitution. And I'd like you to tell me if you agree with Attorney Wellman that the definition is from Van Brocklin, if you have a different take on that definition. But I do want you to confine your answers to the issuance of a search warrant rather than the gazillion of other things that could be going on.
I think that if you take Chapter 7, SCR 75, Van Brocklin, the Strakowski case involving patient compensation panels, that there's ample support for the proposition that search warrants are a quasi-judicial or limited judicial function, and that the issuance is proper. I also think in this particular case, Your Honor, that that issue as to whether or not there should be de novo review or not is not in this case, because Mr. Williams conceded that there was probable cause, that his warrant was properly issued. So I don't think the issue is properly before this court as to whether there should be or shouldn't be de novo review in that case. Because
Counselor, how was judicial power defined when the Constitution was enacted? Do you know?
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay.
Lastly, and my red light went on, counsel talked about elected judges. Certainly, the municipal court under the Constitution does not need to be elected, and that's pretty clear from the 1977 amendment. So I think that argument fails. We do have election of municipal judges, but that's by statute. We've addressed that in our brief, and I don't want to repeat that here. Obviously, it's a fascinating area. I could probably talk for another half hour, but my red light is on.
Well, counsel, I'm checking your brief quickly, and I didn't see it. Are you familiar with the Utah cases?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you familiar with the Utah case, the Utah?
Yes. And we have a footnote in our brief distinguishing the Utah case.
And what's the distinction, so I don't have to look it up?
The distinction is that Utah, there's... I would rely on the footnote in our brief, Your Honor.
Okay, because when I read it, I thought the Utah Constitution, like ours, said judicial powers vested in courts and set it forth, and which is a very traditional statement of the separation of powers. Now, I haven't gone back and done a 50-state study, but I can check the compendium, which is a little out of date, but... and see what it is, but I think it's pretty uniform. Doesn't mean we have to agree with Utah, right?
Exactly. I think Chadwick in the U.S. Supreme Court is also instructive because there the U.S. Supreme Court approved the issuance of a search warrant by a clerk. Therefore, I think that case can fairly stand for the proposition that the issuance of a search warrant is not something that has to be done by a full-fledged judge.
Interesting thing about Chadwick is both you and the defendant rely on it. That is, both the state reads it and the defendant reads it to be supportive of their respective positions. So I find that sort of a draw at the moment.
Well, I think it points out that the real issue is probable cause. As long as there's a mechanism that search warrants be issued only on probable cause, it really doesn't have to be that the person that issues it has to have the magical title of a circuit judge as opposed to court commissioner, as opposed to a clerk of a court in another state where clerks have that power.
Thank you, Mr. Axelrod. Mr. Hurley.
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to say Chadwick stands for the proposition that the neutral and detached magistrate, which the Constitution requires to issue a search warrant, does not have to be a lawyer or a judge. And in Chadwick, the underlying state constitution permitted judicial power to be vested in someone who is not a lawyer or a judge, just as ours used to permit the legislature to vest an individual with judicial power in the form of a court commissioner.
Counselor, how was judicial power defined at the time the Wisconsin Constitution was enacted?
As with all aspects of power, I think the founders thought it was best to leave it undefined. And I don't know of any definition of judicial power at the time of the initial drafting of the Wisconsin Constitution.
Who could issue search warrants at the time the Constitution was ratified for Wisconsin?
You mean other than judges?
Well, whatever
I don't
you
know,
know.
I don't know the answer to that question, Justice Robinson.
Okay.
Other than judges. I understand every one of your concerns about the efficient functioning of the courts if powers currently being exercised by court commissioners were constricted. I get that. But it's not a constitution of convenience. It is, as I said before, there was a fundamental structural change at the time of the 77 Amendment. And that structural change took away the legislature's power to invest any individual with judicial power. And it has been enforced. And this court, in Wolke and other cases, has stated repeatedly that court commissioners, when they perform their functions, do not sit as a court. They are neither judge nor court. And so what we have is a post-amendment scheme by which some unelected individual who is neither judge nor court is making decisions which alter people's fundamental rights to property and to liberty. And specifically in this case, with respect to a search warrant, an individual, a very nice individual, a very capable individual in my experience, but nonetheless not elected, not a judge, not a court, issued a warrant which was used to permit police to go into a man's home and take things.
Counselor,
and there was no review.
In fact, Counselor, my research turned up other people than judges issued search warrants when the Constitution was ratified. Would that affect your definition of judicial power in regard to search warrants?
No.
Why not?
Because the equivalent of Section, the now repealed Article 7, Section 23, was, I believe, extant in some form at that time.
You have some of the cases listed on pages 10 and 11 of your brief. One was Faust, which dates back to 1878, which we referred to revised statutes. And you distinguish that on that it's based on Section 23. That's the commissioner one.
That is correct.
And you already talked about Wolke. So you would distinguish those. And that just and the Faust one was that the one that was a justice of the peace?
Yes.
Yeah. And then the Constitution talked about courts in chambers or judges in chambers, or statute did, which was a limiting factor.
Yes. A limiting factor on the extent to which they could be invested by the legislature with judicial power.
I'm sorry, we interrupted your train.
It's quite all right. With respect to a search warrant, there is no form of subsequent review which can return the citizen back to his position ex ante, that is, before the right to be secure in the home was transgressed by state officials. And I understand that this court is, in its mind, going to seek for some solution if it determines that court commissioners cannot perform judicial functions. What then can a court commissioner do, as I was asked right away? A court commissioner can do that which either by review, de novo, or in whatever form, can return the citizen back to their position ex ante. That is, before any harm was done. Your Honor's asked about a small claims action. In a small claims action, is that appealable or reviewable de novo? Yes, it is. But between the time of the court commissioner's decision and the time of the de novo review, wages may have been garnished, bank accounts may have been garnished. And that de novo review is not going to return the citizen back to the original position. Just as in this case, any form of review of a search warrant will not return the citizen back to the original position. And that's really what's at issue here. Is a court commissioner affecting someone's liberty or property or relations with other people in such a way that they cannot subsequently be returned to their original position if the court commissioner was in error? And that is the bright line, I believe, that this court should draw.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. I want to thank you, Mr. Hurley, and you, Ms. Wellman, and you, Mr. Axelrod, for your excellent arguments and your instructive briefs in this matter, raising an issue of the interpretation of the Wisconsin Constitution and what judicial power means and the powers of court commissioners who, both family court commissioners and the court commissioners, play a very important role in the administration of justice in this state and have for many years. So that concludes our hearing on 10-AP-1551-CR, State versus Douglas M. Williams. And the court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case. And students who can should remain so that they can meet with Justice Robensack, and anyone else who wishes to attend, they do so. We are in recess until 1:30.